Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Dead Rock Stars with Mick Wall and Joel McIver.
Welcome everyone to yet another killer episode of Dead Rock Stars. Now you may notice, you may not, but you may notice that the general ambiance of our voices is a little echoey today, and that's because we're recording in a different location. Because like the people we talk about in our series, Mick, we're international travelling rock stars, essentially, would you say?
But not dead.
But not dead yet.
Yet.
That is still some time away. Now, I'm here with my dear friend Mick Wall.
Are you going to explain why it's echoing?
It's echoey because we're in a different place with a larger room.
And we're both naked and it's a shower room.
Yeah, budget's been slashed, unfortunately, at 7Digital, so we're doing the best we can. Anyway, it's appropriate, really, because we're talking about country rock today, which is a sort of raw, primitive music.
Well, can I just stop you right there?
You may.
Yeah. Country rock.
I believe that's the term at hand, isn't it? Country rock? Correct me if I'm wrong, please.
You would describe Lynyrd Skynyrd as country rock.
I would. Tell me if that's wrong.
Tell me how it's right.
I had assumed that because...
you had assumed it. Have you ever heard their music?
Yeah, many times.
Never heard anything by Lynyrd Skynyrd?
Come on, tell me where I'm going wrong here.
Well, tell me why you think it's country rock, because you've brought this up, not me.
Okay, fine. Well, where does it stand in the sort of pantheon of country? It's not your old traditional country and Western music, but there are country elements, I'm right.
I think what you're grasping for is southern rock.
Well, define that slight difference for me, for the people who don't know.
You're the only man in the world that doesn't know. I don't have to define that difference.
Just in case.
Are Molly Hatchet a country rock band?
Well, that's a very good question.
Were the Allman Brothers a country rock band?
They had some country in their sound.
Were they a country rock band, yes or no?
I'm going to plead the fifth on that. Yeah. Tell me.
No, they fucking weren't. They were a rock band that came from a certain part of the country.
Yeah.
That informed their sound.
Florida in the
but
case
they
of
did
Lynyrd
not,
Skynyrd.
The only thing country about Lynyrd Skynyrd was the hat that Ronnie Van Zant used to wear. And I don't mean on his head.
So we're talking about a southern rock band as opposed to a country rock band.
At last, the light comes through the blinds.
I genuinely was not aware that there was a significant difference. So tell me, man, you know, fill me in here. What's the difference?
Okay, what's the difference between Metallica and country rock?
Are you then suggesting that the differences are huge between your country rock and your southern rock?
No, I'm just suggesting they
rock.
Are obvious.
Please run me through them. Come on, we've got to get to this point somehow.
Okay, Hank Williams?
Yes.
Country?
Yes. Country, definitely, yeah.
Yes. Johnny Cash?
Country for sure.
Okay. Allman Brothers? Come on, you can do it.
Well, see, I would have said country rock. But you're saying
okay,
southern
what
rock,
country you know? Song did the Allman Brothers do?
It was called Down at the Shanty at Tea Time.
Let's start again. We're talking about Lynyrd Skynyrd. Definitely not fucking country, fucking rock. Not that there's anything wrong with country.
Nothing
rock.
Wrong with being country?
Nothing wrong with being country. Just don't be a cunt about it.
Southern rock. Where does it start? Where does it finish?
Oh, I don't think you... That's like saying, where does the blues begin and end?
Yeah,
I think
okay, that's fair.
Can we get off on the right foot now and say this episode of Dead Rock Stars concerns Ronnie Van Zant.
Ronnie
the great
Van Zant.
Ronnie Van Zant, who no one in history has ever thought of, oh yes, country star Ronnie Van Zant.
Is it really that inaccurate? No, country, I wouldn't say straight country, clearly.
Yes,
not
it's that
Nelson.
Fucking inaccurate. Have you actually ever heard a Lynyrd Skynyrd album?
Yeah, many of them.
Because Led Zeppelin had country tunes. I wouldn't call them country fucking rock.
Yeah, yeah, okay. I think we've established our point fairly well at this point.
Okay,
yeah, yeah. So
right.
We're talking about Ronnie Van Zant.
Yes, apparently. Have you heard of Ronnie Van Zant?
Yes, I'm familiar with
his He was a fantastic singer in a fantastic band called Lynyrd Skynyrd, and he died tragically young at the age of 29.
29 only.
The kind of highlight facts are that they came from Jacksonville, Florida. They didn't come from Alabama, but as they once said, Sweet Home Jackson doesn't quite have the same ring about it as Sweet Home Alabama.
Doesn't scan, no, indeed.
They formed in high school.
Yeah.
Named themselves after a particularly recalcitrant gym teacher.
Lynyrd Skynyrd.
Lynyrd Skynyrd. And that's why the band is pronounced Lynyrd Skynyrd.
Yeah.
And in fact, the title of their first album, pronounced Lynyrd Skynyrd,
yeah.
Known forever after as Lynyrd Skynyrd.
I was reading about the teacher who went to have a little bit of fame after this. Yeah, yeah. He only died a few years ago.
Did he?
And he, probably the most famous PE teacher there's been, you know what I mean? And he never really enjoyed being the guy that propelled Skynyrd to fame and fortune. But at the same time, he recognised it with a sense of humour and became a bit of a legend in his own right. Which is a nice little interlude.
And did he know they thought he was a twat?
Well, I'm not sure that's been expressed on the record. I think, you know, he knew that they were rebelling against his sort of no long hair regime and all this stuff. But
yeah, they hated him.
Yeah.
When they were recording that first album, they had a picture of him on the wall and they would throw darts at it and then shoot bullet holes into it and then set fire to it and bury it in the back of the studio garden.
He wasn't their idol.
That may not be true, but I may have written.
No, but I like your style, dude. I always have.
So, in terms of musical influences,
yeah.
For those of you that feel there is a country tinge to Lynyrd Skynyrd, one of their really big musical influences was Free. They loved Paul Rodgers, particularly loved Paul Kossoff. I mean, what wasn't there to like about Free?
Mm.
But, I mean, that real kind of down-home funk,
yeah.
As well as that firebrand rock. And of course, being where they come from, the southern states of America, it was more about R&B, more about the blues, more about that thing that the Allman Brothers had captured just before Lynyrd Skynyrd came along.
Yeah.
So given the era, the late 60s, early 70s, it was very much a rock phenomenon.
Yeah.
These were guys with hair down to their belt buckles. Country stars might have that now, but in 1970, that would be likely to get you shot if you tried walking down Main Street, Nashville, looking like that.
What was, what was Jacksonville, Florida? I mean, the modern reference to Jacksonville, believe it or not, comes from Limp Bizkit, the rap metal band.
Right.
Who describe themselves as redneck motherfuckers from Jacksonville.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah, it's very much in the heartland
redneck
of that kind of
territory,
redneckery.
But you're talking boogie. You know, you're talking boogie.
Yeah, yeah,
you're talking blues. You're talking man's music.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
None of this lonesome heart train whistling that you love.
It's funny, we were talking about the Abbott Brothers, were we not, the other day?
Vinnie
Paul and Dimebag.
Oh, yeah.
And how them being Texan
informs
their music to its very
core. So would you say Pantera were a country rock band?
Are you saying there's no country in Skynyrd sound?
Would you say Pantera were a country rock band?
Influenced by...
Really? Really?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
That whole sort of down home outlaw
stuff. I agree
with
you. I'm only teasing.
No, you can tease. I like it when you tease.
Okay, all right. This is turning into a very different kind of a podcast. So here we are, ostensibly discussing Ronnie Van Zant, whose only country influence was his hat and his cowboy boots. I suppose you could call it cowboy boot rock.
Well, that's a step towards it, right?
Hey!
Oh, we're on fire.
Take your partner by the hand.
That's it.
No, this is a rock band.
Yeah,
this is a defiant, rebellious rock band. This is Rebel Yell.
What were they rebelling against?
Everything. What you got? What was anybody rebelling against in those days? The man!
Yeah, man, as personified by Mr. Skynyrd.
You know.
Teacher extraordinaire,
We were just rebelling against the fact that the pigs needed offing.
Yeah.
And fuck the government. So one of the very first songs they write is this, and this actually, in a musical sense, does define them as not being country rock.
Yeah.
Is this 12-minute rock epic that owes its ambition, its musical architecture, owes much more to the Doors, to the Beatles and Led Zeppelin, groups that had composed rock songs that actually were almost operatic in scale.
And unconstrained by conventional sort of
unconstrained by the idea of making a 3-minute hit.
Yeah.
And this is, of course, Freebird.
Do you like that song?
I think I liked it the first 400,000 times I heard it.
Yeah.
But it's one of those weird songs. It is like Stairway to Heaven.
Yeah. You know?
I mean, I really don't need to ever hear it again.
No. It's in the DNA, isn't it?
But should you be in a position where it's thrust upon you, it's still a great musical moment.
It is. You have to like guitar solos to enjoy it.
Well, if you like rock music, it's a fair bet that that's probably part of your makeup.
It's true, but you have to endure an insane amount of guitar solos.
This from the man who likes Cannibal Corpse.
Yeah, that's it, yeah. As you say, it's a long old thing. 9 minutes, I think, on the original record. I last saw it used in a film called The Devil's Rejects, a horror film, sort of country horror film. Not a southern horror film, country horror film. And in the final scene, there was this sort of huge blood bath shot in slow motion. Very Sam Peckinpah style. And they used the whole of Freebird, the entire 9 minutes, to soundtrack this one scene of carnage, which was really, really well done.
Wow.
It's directed by Rob Zombie, the singer.
Right.
And anyway, that's the last instance of its being used, but it's been used incessantly, right?
It was in Forrest Gump.
Yeah.
Well, it's used in the same way, you know, if Jimmy Page wasn't so totalitarian about his allowing the use of Stairway to Heaven in certain things, it would be just as ubiquitous, you know, because it's one of those, if you're trying to signify a certain thing, it works extremely well.
Yeah.
But of course, the song that introduced Lynyrd Skynyrd to the world is Sweet Home Alabama.
From the second record.
From the second record, Second Helping. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the famous story behind that was they had written the song and they rang up Al Kooper, who had signed the band to MCA, already considered the worst record label in America at that point.
Why was that?
Because they were just shit. You know, they couldn't make a hit record if their fucking lives depended on it. Mm-hmm. In fact, Lynyrd Skynyrd later on recorded a track called Working for MCA, which was another one of their big anthems.
Yeah.
And that was very much against the man, because MCA were crap. I was just explaining to Ian before we came on air that for a while, MCA was known as the Music Cemetery of America.
Yeah,
that's
I was
how bad
say
the label
well.
Was.
I thought of that as well, just as you said it.
In fact, I think it was you that told me, and then I told Ian.
That's it. But no, you remember you said it to me earlier. You texted it to me, mind you, to tell you. Yeah, no, it's me. Everyone knows that fact.
Dead Rock Stars. Carpe diem, baby.
I mean, they do have three guitarists. How on earth do you make three guitarists work? I mean, the Allman Brothers had two drummers.
Iron Maiden, Radiohead. They all failed.
Radiohead
failed
don't
to
have
make
three guitarists.
I'm afraid they do.
Do Radiohead have three? The thing about radio is you'd never know they have three guitarists.
No,
you
wouldn't. Well, there you go.
I mean, I can't see
where
them
have all those guitars gone in the
The
mix,
day
right?
they do Freebird as an encore and show me what they got.
Yeah, imagine.
Yeah. As for Iron Maiden, bless their hearts.
Well, bless
the They don't heart. Need three guitars,
no,
do they?
No.
I mean, they survived perfectly well with two for about 20 years.
No, it's an ongoing...
And then because no one had the heart to get rid of Yannick...
Dear old Yannick.
Now we have three.
And then there were three.
The magic sauce, of course, in Lynyrd Skynyrd, as there's so many rock bands, possibly them all, was the frontman.
Yeah.
And in Lynyrd Skynyrd, of course, Ronnie... He's part sheriff, part leader of the gang, part Jesse James. And before you get into the country thing, I'm not so much a cowboy as an outlaw.
Yeah, I'm with you. Yeah.
One of the really odd things about him, and of course you and I have known so many rock musicians and young rock stars that talk about, I'll be dead before I get to 30.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah. Pete Townsend, hope I die before I grow old. Lemmy, I don't want to live forever.
Yeah.
Liar. But Ronnie Van Zant would tell his wife, would tell his best friends, anybody that would listen, to the point of tedium, that he would not make it to 30.
It's chilling, isn't it?
Well, he died 87 days before his 30th birthday. And it does, I mean, it sounds crass, but when you look at the detail and how many people talked about this, it's almost a death wish. You know, it's almost kind of like he wants to die before 30.
It wasn't sort of young man's bravado?
I think so.
Yeah.
In his case, though, it does seem to have become a kind of centre of his belief system.
Yeah.
you know, in terms of how he then lived his life.
Ah, so what kind of lifestyle did he lead?
Well, one of the reasons I became a rock writer back in the
country rock
middle and late 70s was a friend of mine in those days, Peter McCoskey.
Oh, yeah.
Who's now a very well-known rock writer. I used to share a hippie type of place with his sister lived there as well. I got to know Pete. And I found out he was a writer of a Sounds magazine. And I remember thinking just how boring that job must be because, you know, you get to a show, you watch the show, and now you have to go home and write about it.
Yeah.
To me, that seemed cruel and unusual punishment for going out and enjoying yourself.
Sort of a way of making the experience very dry and boring, you mean?
Yeah.
Distilling it into words. Yeah, I see.
Yeah, and I just couldn't. Anyway, he came to visit us. He'd just got back from the southern states of America, where he'd been writing a story on a group called Leonard Skinner, who, of course, I'd heard of because this is like 76 at this point.
Yeah.
So a year before the fatal plane crash.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
And he'd written about them early on. And so they, you know what it's like, they embraced him, you know, as bands that you've helped along the way.
Yeah. We call it ball cupping in my area of journalism.
Do they?
You cup some balls, help them along a bit.
Is that what they call it? And is that the same when you do your music journalism as well?
Go on. So
when you're not down the gym.
So there was some mutual ball cupping going on between Pete and Skinner.
I don't think Ronnie Van Zandt would have appreciated.
Metaphorically.
I tell you what there was going on. Pete described being on the back of the motorbike holding on to Ronnie Van Zandt.
Yeah.
Literally, no helmets or, you know, hand signals.
Yeah.
Off they go.
He hadn't studied the highway code.
No
mirror
highway
signal
code.
Maneuver, none of that.
None of that this side of the road business. And they turn up at some biker's bar in the middle of the swampland somewhere.
Yeah.
And it is just all hell breaks loose. It's boozing, drugging.
What kind of drugs?
Cocaine, weed, probably, you know, that beautiful biker-made speed that keeps you awake for 3 weeks and leaves you psychotic for the rest of your life. Possibly
open.
Some of that, if you're a real man, you know, if you're looking for a proper good time.
Possibly some whiskey.
Very much some whiskey,
might have
been
some whiskey.
Bourbon.
So Pete endured all this. I mean, he was right in there.
Of course.
What a man. That's brilliant.
Anyway, this goes on till 5 a.m. Next thing, there's an altercation between one of the band and one of the gang members.
Yeah, yeah.
Next thing, there are firearms drawn.
Oh, heavens.
Bullets fired. And then, get on the bike! Get on the fucking bike! Get on the fucking bike!
Fucking
I'm listening
hell.
To this going, what the fuck?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because this was the social media in those days, was people telling stories.
Of course.
And I said, how long were you out there with them? He said, about 2 weeks. And I remember thinking, I was working in an employment agency at the time. And I remember thinking,
where was the employment agency?
In Acton High Street.
It's all a bit different. In
West London.
From Florida. Yeah.
And Acton is not so great now, but back in those days, it was, you know, like across 110th Street, you know, fucking awful.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's where I worked, in an employment agency. They gave me a job because they couldn't find any other job for me. That's where I was in my career. So I lived in this hippie house for £20 a month. And by some bizarre coincidence, I'd lived there 3 months rent-free because I had stoned one day, gone into a painting and decorating shop. I had a competition. Guess the value of all these pots of paint and you can win £100. And I guessed it and I won.
And what did you do with your £100?
Well, 60 went on 3 months' worth of rent at the hippie place, and £40 kept me going for about the next year, you know.
Mate, that's one of the best stories we've yet had on this podcast.
Well, when I'm dead, we'll be able to resurrect that snippet.
Mate, I'm going to carve it on your gravestone. No, I'm going to put a load of paint next to it.
That's assuming you're still around.
Yeah, I'm going to make no such assumption. Yeah, yeah.
So anyway, I'm going to work. I'm waiting for the bus the next morning in the pissing rain at about 8:30. I'm thinking, what a fucking life that guy Pete lives, you know.
Yeah.
Now, imagine, this is 1976. Imagine if he'd just been on the road with Brotherhood of Man, you know. I'd have probably thought, one thing you will never catch me doing is writing about fucking music.
Yeah, right.
Save your kisses for me.
That
they had a detectable country
song.
Influence.
No, they were more Southern England rock.
Southampton. But rock. Outlaws, nonetheless.
You're not heard of it? Outlaws in their own.
Home County Outlaws. That's...
Luckily, we were just talking bullshit at that point. I might as well have a coffee while we're there.
Is that meant to do that?
Right? Use me.
We're not burning it out, are we? Don't make me burn out another... No, I'm all right, thank you.
Oh, that was brilliant. Right, I'll just do this and we'll get back to it.
That's quite funny. I'm going to leave that in.
Oh, yeah, it'd be funny.
Okay.
So, Mick, Skinner had a personal meaning for you, right? Because they dragged you kicking and screaming into rock journalism.
In a roundabout way.
In manner of speaking. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. I mean, along with bands like Thin Lizzy, The Stones, Led Zeppelin, they represented danger.
All right.
Or they represented something that went beyond the norms. Not just in the sense of, oh, this is crazy, but in the sense of, fuck you, you know? Yeah. Fuck this job. Fuck that guy.
Yeah.
And fuck all of this.
And something completely different in every single way to grey England in 1976.
Yes, yes. And of course, they were real. I mean, that's the thing about rock stars like Ronnie Van Zant is people overlook the fact that they were real. And I think particularly from our vantage point here, you know, over 40 years later, you know, we've got the President of the United States lawyer saying truth isn't truth, you know. What is real? I don't even know anymore. But back in 1976, I knew Leonard Skinner.
See, this is an overarching theme of what we talk about here, because quite often we look back a few decades and it was a completely different world.
Yeah.
And one of the major points you've just made is that you knew what was what back then, right?
Well, you certainly knew what Leonard Skinner were.
They were a southern rock band. Right, listen, this is a band of two halves, isn't it, very much, in terms of their career. They had that first period. Then the horrendous thing which we're about to discuss. And then they came back and they just announced their farewell tour. I don't know if you picked up on that.
True, but yeah. I'll remind you, we're here to talk about Ronnie.
Well, fine. So you then, in 76, did you say? That was when you first became aware of them running around being crazy and going out with people.
Yeah, I mean, I knew their music before then.
Well,
I mean,
they were ubiquitous
on British TV. They were on the old Grey Whistle Test. You couldn't escape Freebird. You know, if you went to a gig, if you went to see Uriah Heep at the Hammersmith Odeon in 1975, they'd be playing Freebird in the interval, you know. They probably played it at David Bowie concerts, you know. I mean, it was just one of those things Stairway to Heaven or Whole Lot of Love, All Right Now.
Mm.
But, you know, Ronnie Van Zant, I don't know if it's a death wish, that's probably pushing it, but certainly a preoccupation with death, with his own demise. And at the age of 29, you know, on what becomes the final Leonard Skinner album, Street Survivors, you know, Ronnie writes this song, That Smell. Mm. Do you know that song?
Yeah, it's partly about Alan Collins.
I guess the specifics might be that, but he was also writing about himself because he'd actually crashed his car, wrapped it round a tree just a few months before, was lucky to walk away from it, should have been killed.
Yeah.
And, of course, he was writing about the world they lived in because, you know, me sitting at home in London thinking of this group of hellraisers in the swamp with their bikes, you know, if you live that life, there's nothing particularly romantic or novel about it. It's truly dangerous. And he talked just 3 or 4 months before he died about the forebodings he had. He said he wrote that song, you know, the chorus, ooh, 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 that smell, the smell of death surrounds you. And he talked about how he had this real feeling that things were about to go drastically fucking wrong.
Tits up.
Some terrible kind of forces were lining up against them because things have been going their way for so long. You know, people forget at the time of the plane crash, they were literally one of the biggest bands in the world. Their new album had come out just a few weeks before, gone gold within 2 days.
Yeah.
And yet here they are flying around in this absolute piece of shit.
Right. Which airplane. They described as the Clampett's airplane, didn't they, right?
Yeah.
Old banger that was just about holding itself.
A 30-year-old Convair prop plane.
Now, did this belong to them or was it rented?
You know? No, they rented it.
Yeah, you're right.
Peter Rudge, who was their tour manager, British guy, had tour managed famously for the Rolling Stones in the late 60s and early 70s, was very much the tour manager du jour, you know.
Mm-hmm.
If Richard Cole hadn't been so ensconced with Led Zeppelin, you could easily have seen Peter working with them.
Okay, yeah.
He comes to the camp and he does a deal, $15,000 in three installments, to have this heap of shit fly them around the southern states. The very flight before the fatal one, 10 feet of flame had shot out. They only had two engines. Mm. 10 feet of flame had shot out of one of the engines, causing Cassie Gaines, one of the backing singers, Steve Gaines' sister, to say she was never getting on that plane again. And they sweet-talked her into it. They more or less dragged her onto it.
Christ.
And she was one of the ones that died in the crash. Peter Rudge, ironically, would never travel on the plane. He always used to travel first class in regular commercial air flights. Something which, in fact, they were really pissed off about and had vowed this would be the last time they ever flew in the Convair and that afterwards they were going to get a Learjet because that's what the Stones had.
Real bands did,
yeah.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Dead Rock Stars with Mick Wall and Joel McIver.
All right, well, what happened, mate? What was the cause of the, what happened?
Well, there's lots of stories. I mean, there are stories about the two pilots smoking weed and sharing a bottle of bourbon.
Okay.
What actually happened was the engine that caught fire on the previous flight caught fire again and stopped. And although they had just refueled, they'd literally just refueled and taken off. They were suddenly perilously close to being out of fuel.
Yeah.
So either the thing was leaking fuel, which maybe helped cause the fire, who knows?
Yes.
But the second engine then died.
Christ.
And I was reading about this, and this next bit is really chilling, because I hadn't thought it through. I hadn't realised, but the two pilots go into the rest of the plane, only a small plane, tell them what's happened. Both engines are dead, and at this point, we are in free fall. I suggest you get pillows, put your head between your knees, and buckle up tight. And it took them over 10 minutes to hit the ground.
Good Lord.
Ronnie was asleep. They woke him up because he needed to get his seatbelt on. Mm. And he was like, just let me sleep, man. And they're like, but Ronnie, the plane's going down. He gets up, walks to the back of the plane, finds himself a pillow. On his way, he grins. He looks at one of the guys. I forget which one it was. Maybe Ed. He looks at one of the guys, grins at him and shakes his hand. And he said, Ronnie knew he was going to die.
Jesus.
Gets the pillow, back in the seat. And 10 minutes later, 10 of the longest minutes you can ever imagine. Apparently it was dead quiet, other than people pleading to God to spare their lives. A lot of sobbing.
God.
And Ronnie just sitting there, not a word. And the plane comes down at 90 miles an hour.
Skimming some trees over
there. Which take off the wings, burst open the fuselage, separate the pilot cabin from the
body of the plane.
The tail comes off, still move in. By the time it stopped, Ronnie Van Zant was already dead. Blunt force trauma to the head. He went straight into a tree.
At 90 miles an hour?
Yeah. And the two pilots, both dead, they were still strapped into their chairs, but the chairs had been ripped out of the plane and were actually hanging upside down from trees.
Christ. It's like a horror film, isn't it? I can't think of a worse scenario.
And of course, with all horrors, there's this tiny bit of bleak humour, which is that the famously their drummer at the time, the fabulously named Artemus Pyle, was in with the pilots when the second engine went and they were maydaying. They were already maydaying, in fact, for somewhere to land. And the second engine went. And Artemus Pyle's father was a pilot who had died in a plane crash. Oh. And he said he could tell just looking at the pilots, he said they had death in their eyes. They'd clearly never ever experienced anything like that before. They didn't have any training with what to do. One of the guys also on the plane, whose name tragically escapes me right this second, but apparently he went through to the pilots during the 10 minutes when they're whistling through the air.
Yeah.
Because there was no sound. The engines were gone. All they said they could hear was their own plane whistling through the air. God. He went through and said to them, "I hope you motherfuckers survive, because after this, I'm going to kill you both." But they didn't. They were killed. Six people in all died.
The people who were in the
I think
rear.
There were maybe like 20 and six died. Mm. But the people that survived, you know, had to go through months and years of rehab.
Always makes me think profoundly that we are not meant to fly through the sky in a machine of 500.
Well, until you land in LA and it's 92 degrees and you think it's rather nice here.
You know, when you fly to Israel or with Israelis, they clap when a plane lands.
Lemmy used to clap.
Oh, did he? Yeah.
Always.
And he made it to 70 and died.
No, he would clap. You know. It wasn't like people would notice him enough anyway.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
But it would land, he'd go,
oh, a real round of applause.
It wasn't even a kind of a. It was, I am Lemmy, I am clapping. Notice me.
I love that.
Sorry,
story.
I think I just blew Ian's digital eardrum.
And everyone listening.
But,
I can't even summon up a kind of black humoured quip about this because the whole thing horrifies me so much. So he was 29 and he predicted his own death.
He was 29, Christ he predicted almighty. His own death. But also, you know, one of the backing singers had had a dreadful premonition dream two nights earlier where she saw the plane smack into the ground and limbs missing and all kinds of stuff. And of course, you know, the people make a lot of the, you know, the album Street Survivors, the front cover.
Yeah, the lineup of them. Yeah.
They're all standing there swathed in flames.
Yes, right.
So that, to the point where the record company...
There's an alternate cover, isn't there?
They withdrew the album and put it in a different cover because it just was, at the time, just considered too much.
I was a mere child at the time. Tell me, was there much of a furore, an uproar, a kind of feeling of massive sadness and sympathy among the public?
Only in the music press. Different world. You know, no social media. Mm. You know, dear old Vinnie Paul dies... bless him. Mm. And it's all over the internet and everybody gets the message real quick.
Which is a good thing. I think the communication speed is a good thing for us all, I have to say.
Well, the Lynyrd Skynyrd thing, I mean, you know, a news story in Sounds. NME were far too preoccupied by that stage with punk. Mm. Sounds were as well, but they also covered southern rock and heavy metal and stuff like that, country metal. And... So it was a news story. Yeah, I mean, it was a big story. Yeah. But all the details only came out many, many years later.
Of course.
There was a famous piece in Mojo magazine in about 96, which really laid it out. And that was nearly 20 years later.
Yeah.
And it was only then, really, that people grasped the full horror of the situation.
No, I know you said earlier we weren't going to talk about the history of Skynyrd, quite rightly. But the fact that they reformed 10 years later and continue to go till now and have consistently done so, and presumably to large audiences, that just indicates how beloved they are in America, right? They symbolise something, don't they?
Yeah, definitely. And also, they, you know, the magic glow of death. You know, I mean, when Lynyrd Skynyrd relaunched, they launched with Ronnie's brother, Johnny Van Zandt, who did a very passable... I was going to say impression, but that's unfair. It was his brother. It was very close to Ronnie.
Yeah.
It would never be Ronnie.
I'm not sure people complained, did they, about the lack of authenticity or anything like that? People still went to see him for the last 30 years.
I didn't.
Well, me neither.
I actually did some PR for them very briefly in the 90s, And I had zero interest in seeing them. Not because I didn't love Lynyrd Skynyrd, but Lynyrd Skynyrd died on that plane.
Wow.
You know, apart from Collins and Rossington.
Yeah.
I'm not a big fan for facsimiles. I remember years ago in the 90s, someone at a place I was working in said, oh, I'm off to see Black Sabbath tonight, yay! Mm. And what he meant was Tony Iommi and three Sidemen.
Right.
And I said, that's not Black Sabbath. Mm, but to them it was like, no, it says Black Sabbath, and one of them was in Black Sabbath, so that makes it Black Sabbath. But as I always say, if Paul McCartney hires, you know, DJ Ashber and Steven Adler and who knows on bass and calls it the Beatles, is it the fucking Beatles? Of course it's not the fucking Beatles, you know? So, and also, where are their albums?
Yeah.
I tell you what we should do, though, while we're here, before we get onto Legacy.
Yeah.
We should mention Ed King.
Oh, who recently departed.
Who just departed, what, in the last week or so, Now, Ed was a fabulous player. You know, people overlook just how good that band were.
Right. So I guess because it wasn't at first sight about sort of showing off your chops. Perhaps that wasn't what people realised, but the fact remains that these people were all amazing musicians.
Absolutely.
They really were.
They really were. And for me, one of the only bands ever that really did use those three guitars in a really interlocking, interweaving way. Mm. And Ed King was a huge part of that. Mm. And him, Rossington, Collins, bless all of them.
Ronnie's voice, actually, is evocative as hell.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there are other examples, but, you know, because of those two massive hits and all the other stuff, his voice is very much on the airwaves to this day, all these years later, even though he himself has not been around for so long.
Let me ask you a question, though. In Sweet Home Alabama, when he talks about there being a governor, you know, he's referring to George Wallace.
Yes.
Famously right wing.
Yes.
There's also a line about Watergate doesn't bother me. Mm. Does your conscience bother you? Mm. What's he saying? Are we talking about a real redneck kind of a...
Yeah.
Or is he saying something... Because don't forget, Watergate at that time, you know, you and I were chatting about James Brown a while ago. Mm-hmm. James Brown and his band, the JBs, had a very famous track out around the same time as Sweet Home Alabama. Mm. And the chorus was, you can have Watergate, just give me the cash and I'll be great. Mm-hmm. You can have Watergate, just give me some bucks and I'll be great.
All right, got it, yeah.
You know, there was a certain kind of a fuck all this, you know, man on the moon, fucking Watergate.
Yeah.
Who gives a fuck? You know, because the real people are up against proper shit every day.
Civil rights, for example. Right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not saying that's what Ronnie was saying, but whenever I hear that song, you know, he talks about how old Neil Young should remember... A southern man don't need him around anyhow.
So help me out here. What was the politics of the band?
I don't know. All I know is that Neil Young wrote a very famous song of his Southern Man, where he's essentially implying that rednecks are all racist.
And slavery states, right?
Yeah, well, not just that, but right-wing, gun-toting nutcases, which there may be Trump's a bit of truth to that, frankly.
Yeah.
And Ronnie was saying, you know what? Southern man don't need you around anyhow. Mm. Kind of saying, you wet liver, liver-lilied, Canadian. I mean, the fucker's a Canadian.
Even worse, yeah.
Southern man don't need you around.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Was he just a fucking badass redneck?
Well, he was that. Oh, he's badass. But, you know, there is a certain stigma attached to Lynyrd Skynyrd these days. The shallow thinkers among us might think that they're just symbolism of a bunch of rednecks.
For me, that's what they became after they carried on without a proper band.
Because
if you see Lynyrd Skynyrd today on their Endless Farewell tour, it's of the southern states. Mm. And yeah, there's a hell of a lot of Trump supporting, gun toting.
Trailer dwellers.
Absolutely. And Lynyrd Skynyrd, when they came to Britain and did Nebworth in the 70s, there were no rednecks in that audience. Those were thinking people who wanted to lead meaningful lives and who probably saw Lynyrd Skynyrd lowering that Confederate flag as a kind of a ultimate, like, as with the Sex Pistols or the Nirvana, the ultimate kind of provocation.
Yeah.
Fist in the air, defiance, fuck the bullshit.
Dead Rock Stars, a little light in the black.
Can I ask you what you think would have happened had the crash not occurred?
What would have happened is they'd have got their Learjet. They were looking forward to doing their very first headline show at Madison Square Garden, which was coming up.
Yeah.
Street Survivors was a great album. They were still making great records. I mean, That Smell is... It's an unfortunate title, but it's a wonderful song. And I think maybe they'd have carried on. Would they still have been amazing 10 years later? Well, the Stones weren't, Zeppelin weren't.
The 80s happened.
Pink Floyd weren't amazing 10 years after 1977.
Yeah.
You know, so who knows?
Who knows where the creative capital would have gone?
Yeah.
Mm. All right, good. Well, we normally, do we not, Mick, assign marks out of 5 for the star quality and other criteria that we apply to the subject under discussion. Ronnie Van Zandt, was he a star?
Ronnie was definitely a star. I'm going to say 4.
What didn't make him a 5-star star?
Instant recognition.
Yeah.
I think if he wanted to be not bothered by the fans, all he had to do was take that hat off. By the way, on the subject of Ronnie's hat, you know why he used to wear it, don't you?
He was balding.
No, just keep the sweat out of his eyes.
It's our catchphrase. Influence.
That's a really interesting question. There haven't been that many southern rock bands that have really had an impact since. Then you hear Kid Rock mashing Sweet Home Alabama with Werewolf of London.
There's a band called Blackstone Cherry.
Yeah,
who
are decent.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, you listen to Paradise City by Guns N' Roses, and to me there's a real... That could be Sweet Home Alabama. Down, diggle, down, diggle, diggle, down. Join me now, John.
No, I'm about to chime in with there's that Metallica song, isn't there?
Which Metallica song?
Is it the Four Horsemen that has that bit in the middle? And it doesn't really sound like Lynyrd Skynyrd.
So it sounds like out of tune, Lynyrd Skynyrd.
No, it's not that either. It's a different chord sequence. But I'm trying to remember who it was used to really take the piss out of Metallica or out of Lars. I think it was someone like Bernard Doe.
The piss out of Lars.
I'm pretty sure it was Metal Forces.
It wasn't me.
Who wrote in their review of Kill 'Em All, that song sounds like Lynyrd Skynyrd. And it really pissed off Lars. And so I've just dreamt all this. All right, good. Is Ronnie's taste for excess? Now, we've talked a lot about this, actually. Do we happen to know if he shot up smack? Do we happen to know if he squired hundreds of females and all that?
I love that word, squired.
Yeah, I like to throw it in.
Do you mean rogered? I don't know about shot up smack. I mean, all I would say is that in the early 70s, I don't think you had to shoot, you know, shooting up smack's quite a step, isn't it?
Yeah.
Did he ever snort heroin? Probably. You know, I mean,
it's
I don't
beyond
think
the realms of possibility.
I can't imagine Ronnie going, oh, I'm terribly sorry.
Early start tomorrow.
Yeah, a bit early for me, thank you. I'll just stick with the cocaine for now, thank you, Devilish Dave and Motormouth Mike. I'll just have some of that biker speed that you guys are so jolly good at making.
What should we say, 3 out of 5?
No. I would say at least 4. A friend of mine... Not McCoskey, another guy who's also now dead, turned up to interview Ronnie Van Zandt when they were in London. And he said he turned up at 10 in the morning. And in those days, lack of PRs, he just turned up. He banged on his door. He's staying at a suite in, you know, the Hilton or something.
Yeah.
Bangs on his door and he can hear, wait a minute! God damn it! Yeah. Ronnie comes to the door.
Yeah.
He's got no trousers on. Just a nightshirt, a hat,
of course.
His boots, and an open bottle of Dom Perignon. And there's a bird in the bed, and he's like, okay, darling, I got business, so you better get. I said, what time are you? He goes, 10 in the morning. I said, and what was it like? He goes, I just looked like it was 5 in the morning. The curtains are all drawn, whiskey everywhere, you know, paraphernalia everywhere.
Oh, that's brilliant.
You better get.
Death as a career move. Now, we're not talking about Ronnie Van Zandt in the same way we talk about Kurt Cobain, are we?
Do you know what? I don't know. I mean...
They might be in Florida, you know.
Well, I mean, no. Very few rock stars have had the impact that Kurt Cobain had. But in terms of being cut off in your prime, you know, I think you could certainly say that about Ronnie Van Zandt. So death as a career move, I don't think works entirely because... the best was still to come.
Okay.
And I think, in fact, although it's immortalised them, it finished them.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know many people with a ton of Lynyrd Skynyrd albums in their collection. I don't know many people that could name you more than 3 or 4 Lynyrd Skynyrd tunes. Mm. So I don't think it was a particularly good move. No.
All right. Okay, good. Well, here we go, team. How do we get from Ronnie Van Zandt to our next dead rock star, Mick? For God's sake, tell us. Why don't we read this in
You just
you want me
it.
To do it?
Yeah.
Both Ronnie and the next subject, under discussion by my venerable friend Mick and me, were lead singers and the main songwriters in their respective bands. All right, that's quite dull. How about this? Both of their bands were named after real life people. All right. In Skynyrd's case, it was just one person, but our next dead rock stars band was named after 2 different people. While Ronnie sang about a guy called Wallace, our next dead rock star sang about a guy called Arnold. And finally, the departures of both Ronnie Van Zandt and our next dead rock star were predicted to mark the end of their bands. Well, not only did their bands continue, they did so for decades longer. And that, friends, leads us to the end of this fantastic episode. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you very much, my dear friend Mick Wall.
You sounded like you were reading that.
No. I'm gazing into the middle distance.
They just came to you, those heartfelt
magic words.
Words.
Yeah. Thank you very much, everyone, for listening to our country rock podcast today.
And goodbye!